KSDP, 830 AM in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove, KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay, KFPS, 88.1 FM in Falls Pass, and KKQA, 88.1 FM in Accutan, Alaska.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Next week, Wyoming lawmakers will meet at the state capitol to decide what subjects interim committees should focus on between now and next year's legislative session. Wyoming Public Radio's Chris Clements spoke with the chairman of one committee who's the only Native American legislator in the state.
The Select Committee on Tribal Relations is set to hear updates on investigations into missing and murdered Indigenous people, and it could discuss how tribal, state, and federal law enforcement manage crime on and around the Wind River Reservation. Fort Washakie Representative Ivan Posey co-chairs the committee.
The people in the federal system on the reservation, I really don't have that luxury of knowing who's been arrested or what they're arrested for.
That's because there's often as many as three separate jurisdictions involved in criminal cases, including the feds. Posey is a member of the Eastern Shoshone tribe and says one of his priorities for the interim is to have a committee hearing take place off the reservation so that more non-tribal members can attend too.
I think there's still a lack of understanding or a lack of knowledge on tribal issues.
That includes some of his fellow representatives, Posey says. Interim committee topics will be finalized on April 8th. For National Native News, I'm Chris Clements.
A conservative political party in Belfast has pulled the emergency brakes on new plans for Ireland's Indigenous language. As Show McPullen reports, Irish may not be arriving into the island's newest central station anytime soon.
For just a few hundred thousand quid, Ireland's newest and now biggest public transit station was to get signage in the Irish language. Even though it's twice as old as English, Irish has been suppressed for centuries, and it appears to be happening again. Members of the right-wing pro-British party, the DUP, are objecting to the new signs and got a judge to halt their installation, for now. They want a debate in their assembly, which might be required under power-sharing rules created by the Good Friday Agreement. It's the latest chapter in the long saga of a language that dates back to the Roman Empire. For National Native News, I'm Show McPullen in Ireland.
A former tribal assistant chief is sharing his native culture and food through his business. Brian Bull spoke with Jason Harris about Bow and Arrow, a food truck roaming South Carolina.
Harris and his wife, Melissa, have both worked in tribal government and still consider themselves ambassadors of a sort. Only instead of discussing policy over the table, they share Catawba history and culture over the counter.
One of the things that we have not been good at, especially as Catawbas, we don't share our culture as well as we probably should. So that's kind of given us an opportunity to answer people's questions. You know, not only the food, that's just a starting point, but we can actually get into other conversations. It helps bring our communities together even more.
Many visitors to the Bow and Arrow are non-natives, so Harris feels this is a great way to connect with others. The menu has fry bread as the basis for its entrees.
We have the Bow, which is a ground beef-based Indian taco with the trimmings that go with that. And then we have the Arrow, which is chicken on fry bread. Then we have a bison Indian taco. We hadn't seen a whole lot of that out there in Indian country. And then we do a strawberry dish that is my wife's grandmother's recipe, and it is just out of this world.
The Catawba are South Carolina's only federally recognized tribe, so Harris says it's great to represent his culture and share his passion for good food at the same time. The Harris's black and turquoise truck roams the areas on and near the Catawba Reservation, sharing native cuisine to powwow crowds and passersby alike. I'm Brian Bull.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support for law and justice-related programming provided by Hobbs, Strauss, Dean & Walker, LLP, a national law firm dedicated to promoting and defending tribal rights for over 40 years. More information available at HobbsStrauss.com.
Enbridge strives to be a good steward of the environment, a safe operator of essential energy infrastructure, and a good neighbor. More on Enbridge's Indigenous Reconciliation Action Plan at Enbridge.com. Enbridge proudly supports this program.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
The city has the money to be able to do it 1 year, but we don't have the money to make it sustainable. That's the problem.
Delta Junction struggles to keep its only ambulance service. From Alaska Public Media, this is statewide news on Alaska News Nightly for Friday, April 4th. Good evening, I'm Wesley Early. Also tonight, a delay in plans to demolish an old Juneau neighborhood for new housing leaves current tenants in limbo.
I don't know if I could be evicted this summer or I could be here forever. I don't know. I have not heard from the city. Nobody has.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
If domestic violence has touched your life, know that you are not alone. You have the power to break free and build a future filled with love and respect. There's hope and help waiting for you. For free and confidential support, visit notaloneak.org to speak to someone who's trained to help. Every Alaskan deserves to feel safe. This message sponsored by the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault.
The Trump administration has frozen $1 million in funding for Planned Parenthood in Alaska. That's according to Rebecca Gibron, CEO of Alaska's Regional Planned Parenthood Alliance. She says programs in 12 states are impacted by the freeze. The funds are through the federal Title X program. It covers family planning and preventive reproductive health care for low-income families, and it cannot be used for abortions. Gibron says if the funds aren't restored, health care for Alaskans will suffer.
We're talking about cancers going undiagnosed. We are talking about people not having access to annual wellness exams. Sexually transmitted infection rates will spike. So this is a program that absolutely must be protected at all costs.
According to reporting from Politico, the administration froze funds for possible civil rights violations. Those relate to diversity, equity, and inclusion, or DEI initiatives, and to taxpayer-subsidized care for undocumented immigrants. Gibron says Planned Parenthood will operate as normal in the state for now. The two centers see about 5,600 patients in person in the state per year. Gibron says about half their patients use Title X funds. There's only one other provider in the state that uses Title X funds, Kachemak Bay Family Planning Clinic in Kenai. Gibron says Planned Parenthood is examining legal options and will push back.
There are not other providers who will be able to absorb the number of patients with low income who are in need of sexual and reproductive health care. So we are going to fight this every step of the way until these funds get released.
Gibron says Planned Parenthood was notified 2 days before they were supposed to receive the funds that the money wouldn't be available. Meanwhile, the North Slope Borough Clerk has issued a recall petition for the borough mayor. It comes after months of efforts from residents over what they say were, quote, lavish travel expenses by the mayor and his family. The Alaska Desk's Aliona Nidzin reports.
The North Slope Borough Clerk issued the recall petition for Mayor Josiah Alaksarak Patkatak last month after several applications and a legal complaint from a group of residents. They say the mayor needs to be recalled because he used borough funds to pay for his family's travel. Former Assembly President and a petition sponsor, Forrest Dina Olimaun, says those public funds could have been spent to support residents instead.
It may not be much to those that already have, but it certainly is a lot to those that don't have anything to begin with.
The Borough Assembly voted in December to allow officials to receive compensation for bringing their family on business trips. The prior code allowed for travel with family, but did not specify whether family travel costs would be covered. However, Patkatak had received compensation for taking his wife and children on at least 15 trips across the state and country, as well as overseas, before the code changed. Those travel expenses amounted to tens of thousands of dollars and included flying first class and staying at luxury hotels. Patkatak did not respond to calls and emails asking for comment. Angela Cox is the borough's director of government and external affairs and the mayor's cousin. She responded to questions about petitioners' concerns last month via email and said that former mayors also traveled on business with their families. A recall petition was also issued for Assembly President Crawford Podkatak, who is the mayor's father. Petition authors said that when Crawford Podkatak voted to approve the ordinance allowing compensation for officials' family travel, he did not disclose his personal interest in protecting his son. Crawford Podkatak said in a phone call Thursday that traveling with family has been a common practice for borough officials. He also said that the Assembly voted to simply clarify the code.
We've been very open. We disclose through the process who we are and the fact that our people, the voters of the North Slope Borough, voted to put us in these positions.
The clerk said she issued the petition on March 21st, though the group say they only received it this week. Not all the complaints included in their initial application made it into the final version. Residents have until mid-May to collect signatures. After that, the petition would be submitted to the Assembly, and an election would be scheduled within 90 days. In Anchorage, I'm Alona Naiden.
The interior community of Delta Junction is getting its ambulance service back. That's after the area's only private ambulance company ended its contract with the city earlier this year, leading to a fight between residents and officials over potential solutions that lasted for months. As Shelby Herbert reports for the Alaska Desk, the city's struggle to retain emergency medical services mirrors what other rural communities are experiencing.
Delta Junction City Council decided last week that it will partner with a nonprofit organization to fund emergency medical services on about 260 miles of interior Alaska roads. Here's City Council member Pete Hallgren.
The city has the money to be able to do it 1 year, but we don't have the money to make it sustainable. That's the problem.
The city used emergency COVID relief funds to pay for ambulance services for the last 2 years, but the city's ambulance contractor, Delta Medical Transport, or DMT, walked away in January when the relief funds dried up. Now that Delta Junction has found a temporary way forward, DMT is back at the table, but the city's funding model is a little bit different this time around. Here's how it works. The next year of service will cost about $1.3 million, and any deductions from a patient's insurer don't count towards that total. But the nonprofit organization, Rural Alaska Emergency Services, will put up about a tenth of the cost and try to raise even more money from community members. Delta Junction will also try to pay for the service with grants from the state's Department of Health. The worst case scenario, according to Hallgren, is if the city has to foot the entire bill.
The city of Delta Junction cannot afford $1 million a year project. We try to live like a family, namely spend less than you take in. So we overestimate our expenses, we underestimate our income, and generally it's worked out.
For now, it's good news for Delta Junction. But it highlights the unique challenges to operating EMS services in remote parts of the country. A 2019 National Rural Health Association study points to a multi-pronged problem. Most rural EMS agencies across the country are funded by a hodgepodge of grants, local tax dollars, and community fundraising. Think golf tournaments and bake sales. That patchwork of funding doesn't usually provide a revenue stream that can reliably maintain equipment, software, or people. Most rural EMS services are also highly dependent on volunteers, which can be hard to recruit and retain. Like Delta Junction, there's a cluster of communities in South Central that is also paying for those expensive ambulance runs with the help of a nonprofit. Well, actually, the entire EMS network for the Copper River Basin is a nonprofit. Matthew Lorenz heads Copper River EMS, which also survives off grants and community donations. And they're pretty much all volunteer. But with no municipal support, it can be a stretch.
We know we have to be independent, and so we have to live within our means. There's no tax base or future tax base or anything like that that we can fall back on and say we want to expand our services or we need more money from you.
Loren says they run three aging ambulances over 400 miles of road that are often poorly maintained and icy. And in order to keep people on the fringes of their coverage area safe when help is so far away, they push basic first aid classes. It might not be the perfect answer, but back in Delta Junction, several residents told City Council that they're satisfied with the solution. So far, the city's nonprofit partner has raised almost $5,000 in donations per month. Still, Delta Junction City Council says they're heading into uncharted waters. They say they're treating this agreement as an experiment and hope to find a more permanent solution before the year's end. Reporting in Fairbanks, I'm Shelby Herbert.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, an Anchorage group brings step dancing to Bethel's Chamay Festival.
You feel the beats and rhythm. It's like you're vibrant and free. And it's just like nice. It's really nice.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. If you would like to play an integral part in what you're listening to, public media is designed for and made possible by the communities it serves. If you are already a member or corporate sponsor, thank you. If you'd like to learn more about how to become a member or sponsor, it's easy. Start with a call to your public radio station. The greatest compliment to a public media station is when a listener becomes a member. So do your part today by becoming a part of the team officially. Thank you for making a donation.
It's been more than a year since the Juneau Assembly voted to move forward with a plan to demolish the downtown Telephone Hill neighborhood's historic homes and add more than 100 new housing units. But since then, not much movement on the project has happened, which residents living there say has left them in limbo. KTOO's Clarice Larson has more.
Joe Carson rents an apartment on Telephone Hill. He's been living there for 2 decades. Since the city and borough of Juneau took over ownership of the neighborhood's land about 2 years ago, he's been checking his mailbox for an eviction notice. So far, nothing's come.
I don't know if I could be evicted this summer or I could be here forever. I don't know. I have not heard from the city. Nobody has.
The neighborhood is on roughly 4 acres of land on a hill that straddles the state office building downtown. The city took it over from the state in 2023, which had owned it since the 80s. It was originally intended to build a new Capitol complex there, but that obviously never happened. Last year, the Juneau Assembly voted to redevelop the neighborhood to build denser housing there. Members said the decision was in response to Juneau's severe lack of housing. But Carson says that same severe lack of housing is exactly why he and many of his neighbors haven't looked for another place, despite knowing the city's plan.
I don't really have a plan B, to tell you the truth, given what the housing is. If I wasn't living here, I'm not sure what I would do. Because, I mean, this is not a good time to find yourself without housing in Juneau, that's for sure.
Another Telephone Hill resident, Morgan Duffseth, says she's stressed about finding a new place and also worries that the new units built won't be affordable for most residents.
There's a lot of different things you could do with this other than turn it into condos.
Last year, the city put out a request for interest for developers who might want to take on the project. The deadline to reply was in late February, and only one developer responded. It was a Washington and Idaho-based developer called Johnson & Carr. In its response to the city, the company says it wants to take on the project in spite of significant economic obstacles. It outlined a plan to build, quote, no less than some combination of 40 affordable units for all income groups, modest-priced single-level housing for seniors, and, likely, market-rate for-sale condominiums. Here's Tyler Carr with the company.
It does take collaboration with the city to figure out the different financing vehicles that are available for different depths of affordability. So not to be vague, but that's at this level, it still has to be widely bracketed until we get further collaboration from the city and market analysis.
Last year, the Assembly agreed to set a goal for the project to offer about a fifth of the new units at below market rent. But there are no actual mandated requirements in place yet. Those, if any, are likely to be discussed by the Assembly later down the line. Though some members, like Mayor Beth Weldon, have said they worry that adding additional requirements might discourage developers from doing the project. This is her speaking on the topic this fall.
My personal feeling is we should just let an outright bidding war happen and get as much money we can from the Telephone Hill. It's prime real estate. We would get prime costs. And if we go the route of getting the most bang for the buck, then we don't have to put any money into doing any project development or any landscaping or anything like that.
City officials have warned that if the Assembly wants to mandate affordability requirements as part of the development, they can expect to have to pay for it. According to City Manager Katie Kester, the project still has quite a few steps to go before breaking ground.
Telephone Hill will be redeveloped. However, we're, you know, not evicting anyone without having real solid timelines and a plan for what that development looks like. So I know that there's some uncertainty in that.
She says the residents there should be looking for other places to live in the meantime. The Assembly will likely get an update on the project in the coming months and decide on how to move forward with redevelopment. In Juneau, I'm Clarice Larson.
Alaska's largest newspaper has a new leader. The Anchorage Daily News announced this week that Vicky Ho would be stepping into the editor role following the retirement of longtime editor David Hewlin. Ho has worked at the paper since 2015 in various editorial roles, most recently as the managing editor. She says she got her start in journalism in college, working for the University of Texas Daily Texan student newspaper.
It was really close to what a professional working newsroom is like. We had nightly deadlines. I remember having to send pages to the printers. We printed through the Austin American-Statesman at the time. Sending pages to the printers in the middle of the night. You know, you're there until 1 a.m., 2 a.m. Brutal, brutal hours, but maybe pretty well oriented to a college student's lifestyle. And that work just kind of stuck with me, the impact of that and just that sense of mission and the pressure of trying to serve our audiences every day. So I applied to different jobs, and I was eventually hired as a copy editor and page designer at a daily newspaper in Northwest Colorado. It's called the Steamboat Pilot and Today in Steamboat Springs. And I learned a lot in that job. So I was there for about 3.5 years and kind of worked my way up to being the evening editor there. And when I was ready to move on to another news organization, I thought, you know, what kinds of things do I want in my life? What kind of place do I really want to work in? What kind of newsroom environment? What are the journalistic ambitions that might be, you know, drawing me to another place? I saw an opening at the Anchorage Daily News. The newspaper was looking for a copy editor and page designer. So I thought, I'll give this a shot. I've never been to Alaska before. I've never been to Anchorage before. And it's really worked out. My job here has evolved so much, you know, from working on the evening copy desk to being the night homepage editor, then the deputy editor online, then managing editor, and now finally editor, which is a kind of a wild journey.
And I know that now for mainstream news outlets like the Anchorage Daily News, there's kind of a two-pronged challenge. You mentioned that financially it's not as viable. It's harder to get people to support. But also you're competing with news outlets that are less independent, maybe more politically motivated. Sometimes people just who have misinformation. How do you foresee working through that in your new role?
I try to think of people and where people are getting their information from and why. If they're not getting information from us or from Alaska Public Media or Alaska's news source, or if they're turning to other sources of news, I'm really interested in why. And, you know, I think part of it is that our information landscape is so fragmented. I think that a core part of this speaks to trust. And maybe there are people in our community who don't feel seen or heard, or they feel dismissed. I think that trust is just so core to what we do as journalists and how we serve our communities. And, you know, in most cases, I don't think I would ever just write someone off for feeling a particular way or believing a certain thing. I think that our beliefs and where we turn to for information and how we treat each other, that's all coming from a place of, you know, what we care about, what we're afraid of, what we're worried about, what our concerns are. I just want to know those people a little bit more, and I want to know where they're coming from, and I want to understand them.
And so I guess as you take on this new role, what is your vision for the future of the Anchorage Daily News?
I think for the ADN, there is such a long history of really high quality, impactful journalism. And, you know, it's a news organization that, you know, we've been around for a long time. I think this is such a great opportunity for a reset in some ways, and not like blowing the thing up and rebuilding it, but, you know, really taking stock of where we are and what we're doing and how we want to move forward with the journalism that we're doing, how we can do work that is still very impactful, how we can do work that is reflective of the community. how we can do work that, you know, resonates with our communities and serves them. We're long past the time where a news organization can be everything to everybody. And I think we, all of us, just need to figure out, you know, what can we do well? What can we do that others aren't as well equipped to do, and just lean into our strengths? I think more journalism in Alaska is only a good thing. And I can get really excited when I think about, you know, how can we all work together to improve the news landscape and media landscape around the state.
That was Anchorage Daily News editor Vicky Ho.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Public media is designed for and made possible by the communities it serves. Money is generated through estate and deferred gifts enable public radio to provide our listeners, you, with the level of programming excellence you've come to expect. It may also reduce income and estate taxes. Consult your financial advisor or contact your public radio station to learn more. From one end of Alaska to the other and everywhere in between, public media works to provide quality programming and statewide news you can count on and news you can trust. Whether you're listening at home, at work, or in the car, we're grateful to be a part of your day. Thank you for tuning in. The greatest compliment to a public media station is when a listener becomes a member. So do your part today by becoming a part of the team officially. Thank you for making a donation.
The Kowalungan tribe of Unalaska is thinking about recognizing an important figure in Alaska history in a unique way. Benny Benson, the designer of the Alaska state flag, is being considered for posthumous tribal membership. A group of historians published a paper in 2022 explaining that the decades-old understanding of Benson's heritage as Aleutic isn't right. The Aleutic are an Alaska Native ethnic group centered on the Alaska Peninsula, but evidence shows Benson was actually Ununga, with family from the Aleutians. Here's Kowalungan Tribal Council President and Interim Administrator Shaila Shishnikov.
So the request to enroll him as a tribal member, we did have someone submit that enrollment form on his behalf, along with a resolution.
That someone is regional historian and tribal member Mike Livingston, the paper's lead author. He says it's important to document Benson's Ununga heritage to correct, quote, errors in the historical record. Livingston says, quote, I think it's important that we get the facts as best we can, end quote. Both Shishnikov and Livingston say that, to their knowledge, this would be the first time the tribe grants membership to someone who's died. Benson, who was born in Chignik on the Alaska Peninsula in 1912, grew up in the Jesse Lee Home for Children in Unalaska and later in Seward. He created his winning 1927 flag design there as part of a contest for Alaska school children. Shishnikov says the tribe's enrollment committee will consider the membership request. Their recommendation will then be taken into consideration by the tribal council. As for when the council will vote on the membership request, Shishnikov isn't sure yet, given what she describes as the uniqueness of the case. And step dance is an African-American dance form involving stomping and clapping, which shook the Chamai Dance Festival stage in Bethel with its unique percussion. As KYUK's Samantha Watson reports, the Anchorage-based group Synergy Step Team found a way to involve festival-goers in an Alaska-flavored routine.
Over the course of Chamai Festival weekend, the stage became well acquainted with percussion in many forms. Chayuk hand drums to accompany your hawk, pounding taiko drums from Japan. But when Synergy Step began to perform, the Chamai stage became the drumming. The four-person group from Anchorage stomped the stage in rhythmic fashion. Percussive slams and claps accompanied with sharp lines formed by the arms and torso. Step dance is an art form distinctly rooted in African American history. Step has origins in the 1700s, when enslaved people were banned from using drums, when slave owners discovered the instruments were being used as forms of communication. Synergy Step leader Kasha Smith says enslaved people realized the body could be used to mimic those same sounds through stomping and clapping to continue to convey messages of freedom.
You will always have voice with, like I said, within your own body. So it's just kind of nice to have that stillness and wholeness to know that, hey, I always carry a voice and I also carry my ancestors on my back in doing it too. So it's just a really symbiotic experience all around.
Smith says Synergy Step was created exclusively for Chamai. Smith had been in the hip-hop group Flow Zone that performed at the festival last year. Flow Zone implemented elements of Step into their routine, which caught Chamai organizer Linda Curta's attention. She asked Smith if she could return next year with a Step-focused routine.
We were like, absolutely, and you know, since Step is a dance of freedom, I feel like every culture should celebrate that within themselves.
Smith says Step complements the Yerhak focused roster of performances with parallel roots of honoring and caring ancestors through dance. Off the stage, Synergy Step led a workshop during festival weekend. In a buzzing Bethel High School classroom, the four steppers taught festival goers a series of four-step movements with an Alaska twist.
We used whale, raven, bear, and otter as a way to create different sounds and to kind of mimic the different motions that the polyrhythmic sounds of step use, which are hand claps, stomps, and spoken word.
14-year-old Rihanna Bratain from Wasilla says learning the movements in the workshop gives her a big feeling.
Alive? Yeah, I felt alive. Just like you feel the beats and rhythms, like you're vibrant and free. And it's just like nice. It's really nice.
She's here with her little sister, Linka, who is 8 and particularly committed to being a grizzly bear.
How do you feel when you're being the grizzly bear?
Happy and strong.
Strong
and alive. You want to hear another one?
If your sister's ready for it, yeah.
Okay.
Roar!
After some practice, the whales, ravens, otters, and bears are ready to put it all together. It is a percussive success. Later, the participants will be invited on stage to perform in the festival. In a flurry of animal-inspired stomps, claps, and growls, a drumbeat of Synergy Step and the workshop team's own making fills the room. In Bethel, I'm Samantha Watson.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Shelby Herbert in Fairbanks, Aliona Naiden and Rachel Cassandra in Anchorage, Clarice Larson in Juneau, Andy Luskin in Alaska, and Samantha Watson in Bethel. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde, and I'm Wesley Early. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. Sustaining membership offers public media greater financial stability month to month, so consider making a sustaining gift to this station. Thank you. Support for public radio comes from the communities we serve. Whether you give as an individual member or through your business, know that your contribution makes possible programming that informs, inspires, and entertains. We thank you for the role you play in your public radio station. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.
Shadows moon across the mountains, sunlight plays in your wandering hair, hungry eyes, long-legged body. You look so restless as you're standing there.
Mountains.